Today on the 21st Show, artificial intelligence has been a growing force in many of our individual lives. But what does it mean for our collective democracy? We've already had AI used in an attempt at voter suppression when voters in New Hampshire heard from an AI-generated version of President Biden urging people not to show up for that state's primary. Today, we'll be talking through the possibilities of AI in politics, ask whether we're doing a good enough job of addressing them, and learn about some of the surprising places AI might show up. I'm Brian Mackey.
And I'm Joe Biden. All that's coming up today on the 21st Show from Illinois Public Media.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'll get it from here. Airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We've talked several times in the last year about the rise of artificial intelligence and the way it's changing our lives. It's because of AI that things like self-driving vehicles are coming online, at least in certain environments and conditions. ChatGPT has also had a significant effect on the way some of us work. And we can also just have fun with AI.
Frankly, the 21st Show is the greatest show of all shows. Most perfect. They love me there.
We don't agree on much, but we agree on that. The 21st Show is an excellent show.
We made that using a free website we found after a quick search. You can see how people less benevolent than we at the 21st Show are could use tools like that for more nefarious purposes. In fact, back in January, some people in New Hampshire got this call, which was not from Joe Biden, leading up to the primary election there.
What a bunch of malarkey. We know the value of voting Democratic when our votes count. It's important that you save your vote for the November election. We'll need your help in electing Democrats up and down the ticket. Voting this Tuesday only enables the Republicans in their quest to elect Donald Trump again. Your vote makes a difference in November, not this Tuesday.
That, of course, sounds like President Biden, but again, it is not. On the contrary, indications are that the voice you just heard was artificially generated. Now, it's not all bad news. As we'll get into, there are some positive effects AI can have for the future of our democracy. And shortly after that fake Biden call made news, the Federal Communications Commission actually banned robocalls with voices generated by artificial intelligence. But some are saying what happened in New Hampshire is just a taste of what we can expect as we get closer to this November's election. Government officials, state and national, are still figuring out how to address these threats. Earlier this year, as part of our occasional Building a Better Democracy series, we spent an hour talking about AI's role in our politics, present and future, for better and for worse. And as we get ready for our coverage of the Republican National Convention next week, we are revisiting that program today. Joining us for that, first of all, is Andrea Guzman. She's an associate professor of journalism at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb with a PhD in communication. She looks at how we interact with AI and how it's changing our modern media world. Dr. Guzman, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Zizi Papakarisi is a professor and department head of communication at the University of Illinois Chicago. She's also a professor of political science. Her PhD is in new media technologies and political communication. Much of her work focuses on the social and political consequences of online media. Dr. Papakarisi, welcome to you as well.
Morning. Pleasure to be here.
And Samuel Woolley is an assistant professor in the School of Journalism and Media and the School of Information at the University of Texas at Austin. His PhD is also in communication, and he's also the project director for propaganda research at UT's Center for Media Engagement. Dr. Woolley, thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
And I should mention, later on in this program, we're going to be joined by Illinois State Representative Abdel Nasser Rashid, who has introduced a bill in the state legislature to regulate how AI can be used in political messaging. All right, Dr. Papakarisi, I want to begin with you, and we'll get into AI in a moment, but I want to begin by backing up just a little bit. Social media is still a dominant force in our politics and our society. Just talk about generally, how has the way social media changed the way we communicate and engage with politics, both for better and for worse?
Yes, happy to. So here's what I'll start with an overview of what social media do and what they don't do. So they pluralize voices. You know, they make the environment for conversation more populous with different points of view, but they do not de facto democratize. So they connect democratically oriented people. They can also just as easily connect people who are working to thwart democracy or fascists. And finally, they do not by default fix problems or create them. So we're always looking at a combination of personal predisposition, motivation to influence, and then using some of the abilities or the affordances or the potential of social media toward a particular purpose, to persuade the public.
To persuade the public, yeah. Well, one of the things that the public is attempted to be persuaded with is sometimes misinformation and disinformation. And Dr. Woolley, I want to ask you about that in the context of elections. First off, how do you define those terms, right? When is something disinformation versus being, you know, an opinion I disagree with?
Sure. The simplest definition is that disinformation is purposefully spread false content. So there's intent behind it to deceive. Misinformation, meanwhile, is accidentally spread false content. So anyone can spread false content at any time. I'm sure we all have done it in our day-to-day lives. Disinformation, though, does have a longer history and other ties to Russian disinformation campaigns, which were, you know, tied to the Cold War and to current times as well.
And I'm sure a lot of our listeners will probably remember the, you know, Russian interference in the 2016 elections here. A lot of that involved there were actually FBI investigations and Department of Justice charges against Russian military officers, for example, for hacking the Illinois State Board of Elections in one instance. In another instance, hacking the Democratic National Committee's email server and timing the release of those to try and do political damage. Can you talk about, I mean, is that count as misinformation or disinformation, or is that something else? How does it fit into this broader landscape about what we're talking about?
Sure. So social media has really made it possible for nearly anyone to run a propaganda campaign. It just so happens that the Russians and before them the Soviets perfected what they, you know, termed disinformation as part of their broader active measures sort of toolkit. You know, what we see happening now is the use of purposefully spread false content with the intent to manipulate public opinion, to undermine elections, to undermine institutions. And I think listeners should be clear on one thing. It's not necessarily the case that these kinds of disinformation campaigns, whoever is spreading them, are intended to get you to change your vote for a particular candidate or on a particular cause. Oftentimes they're oriented towards getting people to feel more apathetic or to be more distrustful of institutions.
And certainly distrust in institutions is one of the things that we can measure and have seen grow significantly in recent years, right?
That's right. Trust in institutions in the United States and in many democracies around the world is an all-time low.
All right, Dr. Guzman, I want to bring you into the conversation now. What sort of groups of people are particularly susceptible to buying into something that just isn't true they might see on social media?
Right. So when we think about different groups who may buy into something on social media, I think a lot of times people think it's the other guy who buys into that. They don't think of it as themselves as being vulnerable. And I think it's important to keep in mind that we're all vulnerable. It's just that vulnerability may surface itself in different ways. And if I could get one point across to the listeners, it would be a lot of times we carefully question viewpoints or political groups or others that we don't agree with, right? We'll be like, you know what? I know that's coming from this source I traditionally don't agree with, or it's coming from this place. And so we kind of put this extra filter on and we really start to question that. Where we tend not to question as much is with information we agree with or information that is coming from a place we, you know, would kind of historically trust. And I think this is where why that New Hampshire call really concerned a lot of people, because in that instance, you don't necessarily have that, you don't go into it with the mindset of this is someone I need to question. And I always tell people that the most pernicious propaganda is the propaganda that you believe in, right? And so I think we're all susceptible in different ways. And so what I tell my students is to, you know, you have to kind of constantly question and constantly think about the messages that are being sent to you by kind of all sides and all parties.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because if that fake voiced phone call in New Hampshire had been from, you know, President Trump, stay home, don't bother voting, you don't need to vote, people would have certainly heard it more skeptically than they did, thinking it was coming from President Biden.
Yes. And I think the other thing I want to bring in here when it comes to artificial intelligence is a larger context. But for me, one of the most problematic aspects of that New Hampshire call that really doesn't get reported on or get as much airtime, you know, a lot of people have heard about that New Hampshire call and the fact that it used an artificial intelligence generated voice, right? That's what we hear about. But the other aspect to that call was the fact that it was coming from a phone number that was associated with someone within the Democratic Party. And so it was spoofed to a legitimate phone number. And so if people were trying to figure out if that was legitimate, if they had plugged the phone number in and the person found this out because they got a bunch of calls from people who knew them, it would have traced back to someone from the Democratic Party. And to me, this is what we also have to think about. It's not just about the artificial intelligence, but what sort of other context is occurring in and around these messages.
Oh, that is interesting. Yeah. And no doubt it's very easy. We know that. I get phone calls that seem to be from in my town all the time that are robocalls probably originating halfway around the world. All right. We need to take a break in a few minutes. But before we do, let's just lay a little bit more of the baseline for the rest of our conversation by digging into AI in particular. And Dr. Papakarisi, you know, that term's come to mean a lot of different things over time. Can we maybe just break down a little bit of what exactly we mean? And let's start with, you know, chatbots, language models like ChatGPT. We've heard a lot about those in the past year. What do they actually do?
Well, you know, that term has come to mean a lot of things. And actually, it's very frequently used as a convenient scapegoat. Tying back to some of what Andrea commented on, you know, one of the most important things that we heard about that phone call was not what, you know, the content or where it came from, but rather that it was generated by AI. AI is a generally inclusive term. A lot of our technologies are run by what we call artificial intelligence. In our fields, we like to joke about it and say that these forms of intelligence are neither artificial, because, you know, they're generated by humans and often they emulate forms of human intelligence. And, you know, often we talk to engineers who create them and they'll joke back to us and they'll say, well, you know, they're really not that intelligent either. But yes, it takes shape in many platforms that we encounter in our daily lives. And those take on many forms, including ChatGPT, which our students are enamored with, but so are we, you know, because we love experimenting with content that we can co-create with on platforms like Midjourney. But it's important to keep in mind that, you know, I would put under the AI category feeds that are generated by algorithms. You know, that is a form of, that's a co-created collaborative intelligence. So, you know, we're using AI to talk about the future often, when in fact, we're also talking about the past. Many, many different technologies that we've utilized in the past count or are created on formulas that have been generated by humans that very much mimic the structure of contemporary AI.
And one of the things you mentioned, Midjourney, which is a way to generate graphics using AI, and that can lead to something called deepfakes. Can you just briefly say what is a deepfake?
Deep fake, or you know, another term for it is called synthetic media, is artificially created content that looks very, you know, the simplest way to put it is just looks very, very real. The effect is much like we've described it before. So Andrea mentioned what we call the third person effect. So when we encounter deepfake content, we assume that, you know, it's going to affect the other guy, but it's not going to affect me because I'm just too smart for it. And the long-term danger is more important than the short term. This is what Sam was getting to. So in the short term, I think, especially in conversing with others, when we look at deepfake content, we're going to be able to figure out that it's artificially generated. But the long-term effect is that this leads to a spiral of cynicism and a loss of trust in our media, in democracy, in our politicians, in our systems, and how we connect to each other. So that's the broader picture there. One last thing that I want to talk about is 3D deepfakes. So I would be more concerned not about the kinds of deepfake content that we're aware of, but the things that we haven't seen yet, or we haven't heard about, or we haven't talked about. So I'd be a little bit more worried about 3D deepfakes, and not particularly in terms of how they're used in politics, but more in terms of how they're used in interpersonal contexts to defame people, or used in libelous ways, or used in ways that are particularly targeting women in cyberspace.
All right, let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. We're talking about AI in politics, the role that it can have, the role that it's already been having. My guests for this conversation, which we first broadcast in February, were Dr. Andrea Guzman, Associate Professor of Journalism at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, Dr. Zizi Papakarisi, Professor and Department Head in Communication at the University of Illinois Chicago, also Political Science Professor, and Dr. Samuel Woolley, Assistant Professor in the School of Journalism and Media and the School of Information at the University of Texas at Austin. We're going to continue this conversation on the other side of a break. Because the show is on tape, we're not taking calls, but let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. More to come. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are continuing our Building a Better Democracy series with a conversation about artificial intelligence, how it's already affected our elections, and what it might mean for our democracy, depending on what we do about its rise. Okay, and if that wasn't obvious, we did use a free AI tool to generate our return from the break there. Fortunately, I think Mackie AI, as you might call it, was more of a shallow fake than a deep fake. I don't think it's coming for my job quite yet, but our new digital producer, Damian Contreras, was, again, able to do that with just 3 clips of my voice, less than a minute each. This technology is more accessible than ever. And of course, with great power comes great responsibility. So we are talking about all of this with Professor Sam Woolley of the University of Texas at Austin, Professor Zizi Papakarisi of the University of Illinois Chicago, and Professor Andrea Guzman of Northern Illinois University. I should mention we first broadcast this show back in January, so we're not taking calls today, but let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. And Dr. Guzman, do you find that most people tend to understand just what exactly AI is in the first place, especially when it's, you know, seemed to have evolved so quickly over the past couple of years, or at least come into public consciousness so quickly?
Yes. No, I would say people are struggling to understand what artificial intelligence is. And that's actually not their fault. Because if you were to bring a bunch of artificial intelligence researchers into a room, they would have a heated discussion about what artificial intelligence is. And there's multiple reasons for that having to do with how it historically developed. For your listeners, a big part of how the average person sees AI a lot of times is influenced by media. and particularly science fiction, that they may have heard of AI or robots, as well as the new media, news media. And so in a lot of ways, we find that people's understanding and judgments of artificial intelligence are already pre-constructed, and they're pre-constructed around fiction or only partial truths. And this is a big problem. And this is a problem I know a lot of educational institutions are thinking about, civic institutions are thinking about. How do we define artificial intelligence? Because it's not just a singular technology. The artificial intelligence that is used to help, you know, diagnose cancers, you know, is very different from ChatGPT. And so how do we start to introduce and help people understand what artificial intelligence is within the multiple ways it intersects with their life? And in a way that's helpful and doesn't lead back to what Sam was talking about and Zizi were talking about, where people just become so overwhelmed, they just kind of stop engaging.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying there. I think that, you know, the type of artificial intelligence that can, you know, fold proteins gazillions of times and come up with new scientific revelations or beat, you know, the chess masters of the world is a long way from an artificial intelligence that wants to preserve its life and therefore opens the pod bay doors on data.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think, you know, people are starting to understand a little bit more about this when they've had voice assistants in the home or they've interacted maybe with other AI through their work, and they realize, like, man, there's a lot this can't do, which I think also is important to talk about, that, you know, there's limits around all technologies. And I think when we talk about artificial intelligence, we actually have to really, instead of talking about this broad scope of artificial intelligence, talk more about the specific applications, because that leads to a more productive discussion and understanding of what's happening.
Dr. Woolley, the evolution of this technology, it's been in the public limelight lately, but we've already been seeing how new technologies can affect our public discourse. Say more about that.
Sure. So researchers have been studying the use of things like automated bots for years and the impact they have upon public opinion, upon conversations online. You know, dating back as far as 2010, there's been work that shows that political groups and others have used armies of these automated bot profiles on social media to spread particular kinds of content aimed at both gaming algorithms that show us particular trends, but also at attacking particular individuals with hate speech and other kinds of harassment and a variety of other uses. During the Arab Spring and during the Occupy movement, we saw the use of these bots for sort of demobilizing activists by spamming them, by spreading tons of noise. And at the time, there was even discussion that these things were actually artificial intelligence, when in fact they were pretty routinely or rotely automated. There's a blurring of boundaries now. We heard about the use of bots and AI in the 2016 election. Really, it was just pretty simple automated accounts and some other tactics. But things are changing with the advent of our ability to parse larger and larger data sets. At the same time, however, there's a blurry line between what we used to call bots or automation and what we today call Gen AI. And I think both Dr. Guzman and Dr. Papakrisi have pointed to this. It's a problem. I have a colleague here at UT that in computer science that says, when we call it artificial intelligence when it doesn't work, we call it engineering when it actually works. And so that's part of the issue here.
Hmm. How would someone, I guess, how do you know, right? And maybe we can just talk about a concrete way this would manifest itself. Last night, I was watching some of the reaction to the Super Bowl. And of course, you see politicians weighing in. And then you look at all the reply tweets, for example, or, you know, well, whatever, choose your social network that you're reading this on. And I mean, do you just have to assume that some significant number of them are just either bots artificially generated in an attempt to sort of gin up the idea that there's a lot of people who are opposed to this politician? How does an average person think about that?
You have to understand that a large proportion of all web traffic is driven by bots. Not all of it bad, certainly. A lot of it is just benign, or bots are being used to, you know, search for things written to particular software to do routine tasks. But yes, a lot of content on social media and a lot of users on social media are actually bots. You know, one of the things that platforms have to do is report to the Securities and Exchange Commission how many automated or quote unquote fake profiles there are in their platforms. And many researchers think that they've been underreporting how many fake profiles there are on these platforms. Another thing that people will have seen in past elections is calculations of how many of the candidates that are running's followers are fake or automated. And a lot of times it's a very high number. And sometimes that could be because you have people that have bought bots to follow those candidates. But a lot of the time it's actually just because there's a lot of bots on social media and they glom on to celebrity users.
Yeah, I got to say, I don't engage with Twitter very much anymore. I did in the past as a political journalist, but it seems the few times I do go check, it seems like all of my new so-called followers are, you know, pictures of people with Hollywood good looks and, you know, a username that has a lot of numbers in the title, which all suggests to me fake account, right?
Yep.
So, Dr. Guzman, let me return to you, and let's now dive into AI and politics, right? I mentioned the good, the bad, and the ugly. I do want to start sort of optimistically and move down from there. Mm-hmm. In a perfect world, what good could the advancement of AI do for our democracy?
Yeah, that's a, you know, I think a great question. And again, it comes down to, you know, what forms of artificial intelligence are we talking about? So, for example, let's say you're running a grassroots campaign and communication is a key aspect of getting your message out. Well, if you're running a grassroots campaign compared to, let's say, a large, well-funded politician, you know, historically, you don't have as many resources and you don't have as many resources around communication. And that, as we all know, that takes a lot of time. And so there are, for example, a grassroots campaign could use something such as ChatGPT to help them create and scale up what they're doing. You know, they're the ones creating the message, but it can help them refine it. Whereas before they may not have had the people power to do so. And so that can help to, for example, level out the playing field a bit, because one thing we've seen, you know, continuously is that it's being hard, it's harder and harder for true grassroots organizations to get involved in politics just because of the large amounts of money behind, you know, more traditional candidates or political parties. So that could be a way of providing resources and just for any community group really outside of politics, you know, if you're just trying to run a community group and where those types of things can be helpful.
All right, that's one of the potential good uses, Dr. Yes. Papakarisi. What can go wrong, broadly speaking? What are some of the ways AI could negatively affect, for example, our elections?
Everything could potentially go wrong. I mean, we really have to look at this in the same way that we do when we step out into the world. You know, we have to assume that we're going to meet people who are going to want to help us and then people who are not going to have such, you know, beneficial, who are going to want to harm us. And AI is increasingly a part of this world, a bigger part of this world. But I want to talk a little bit about the process at work here. So AI content doesn't just sort of, you know, appear or manifest on its own. And I'm hopeful because we've been studying processes of influence and persuasion for a long time. And we know that usually what happens or what's at work is a two-step flow. So content needs an influencer to get to the masses. Or, you know, to put it otherwise, if you're going to use content or misinformation or AI like a drug to hypnotize people, you're going to need somebody to push it. So I would be more concerned about the upcoming elections in the U.S., but elections all over the world, being the elections of influencers, pushing out content like this. If it's AI-generated content of a crude nature, right, like the robocall or like the bot-generated messages that we see on Twitter and we can detect as being fake with just like a little bit of very simple detective work that we've all learned to do since the past, in the course of the past two elections in the United States, I'm not too worried about it. But I am worried if it's more sophisticated content. I'm also worried about the more vulnerable populations being exposed to it. And I'm also worried about situations where people are being exposed to that content on their own, so they don't have anybody to discuss it with, or the people that they are discussing it with are of the same ideological background. So then we're seeing these ripple effects generated in terms of believability and finding that content to be credible. And one last thing I want to get in there, I'm worried about all of us spending too much time talking about things that are fake instead of talking about things that are real. You know, what we're missing out at the expense of focusing, shifting our attention away from issues, and then attempts to shift our attention away from those real issues.
Oh, that's an interesting point. You know, Dr. Woolley, what I hear here is all the major sort of social science horribles we've been hearing about over the past decades, right? From bowling alone, people are more isolated, to people grouping together. The precise term for that is escaping me at the moment, where they sort of select into communities of like-minded people. It's all coming together. And when you feed in these, the sort of content that we're talking about, talk more about what happens, how this confluence of social trends we've seen over the past decades are, making to use a terrible cliche, but a perfect storm of people who are susceptible to this sort of thing.
Yeah. So I think the term you're referring to is homophily, or this idea that birds of a feather flock together, people congregate where people like them also congregate. And social media makes that more possible. Listeners will have heard of things like filter bubbles and echo chambers, and they'll know that, on social media, content is often tailored to particular users and groups of users. And that means that the content that one person encounters can look quite different from the content that another person encounters. And that's based upon our online behavior and a number of other factors. Some people have described this as a perfect storm, where people's information environments are becoming increasingly more segmented. You have books like Network Propaganda by a group of scholars at Harvard arguing that effectively media organizations ranging from a variety of conservative publications to social media have made it so that people, particularly on the far right, get a completely different set of news than people across the rest of American politics. I think that Dr. Papakrisi is right to point out that we should be careful to talk about only what's false and only what's going poorly. I think that people are more aware than ever before about the problems that we're discussing. You have people logging off of social media, deleting their Twitters and their Facebook accounts and their Instagrams. You also have a move back to quote unquote dumb phones. There is a reaction going on. It's just that with the advent of new media, each new media, whether it was the printing press, the television, or the internet, you have a lot of change and you have a lot of confusion. And the internet is obviously all of these things on steroids because of the access to information and the rate at which people receive it. So it's going to take us commensurately a bit more time to respond and recover.
All right, let me remind listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are continuing our conversation about artificial intelligence and specifically how it relates to American politics, our elections, and our democracy more broadly. After the break, we're going to hear from State Representative Abdel Nasser Rashid, who introduced legislation to regulate the role of AI in politics. We have been talking with Andrea Guzman, Zizi Papakrisi, and Samuel Woolley, all PhDs in communication or journalism. This program was first broadcast in February, so we're not taking calls live today, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. If you want, you can also go to our website, where you can find some of our great recent conversations, like one we had just yesterday about President Biden and whether he should stay or exit his re-election race. That conversation generated a lot of interest from listeners. You can hear from people across Illinois, as well as political commentator, journalist, and political scientist Nick Grossman from the U of I. That's all on our website, 21stshow.org. More to come on AI in politics after a short break. Stay with us.
If you're just tuning in, it's the 21st show. I'm an artificial version of Joe Biden. We are continuing our Building a Better Democracy series with a conversation about artificial intelligence, how it's already affected our elections, and what it might mean for our democracy, depending on what we do about its rise. Back to you, Brian.
Thank you, Mr. Not actually the president. We have been talking about this with three professors of journalism or communication, Dr. Andrea Guzman of Northern Illinois University, Zizi Papakarisi of the University of Illinois Chicago, and Samuel Woolley, who is an assistant professor at the University of Texas, Austin, and also project director for propaganda research at UT's Center for Media Engagement. This is very much a live issue. We first broadcast this conversation in February, and at that time, State Representative Abdel Nasser Rashid, a Democrat from Justice, Illinois, had recently introduced legislation aiming to regulate the use of AI in political communication. I began by asking him how he has seen that playing out in his field.
Thanks, Brian, for having me on. Always good to be back. AI has been, as we know, transformative over the last couple of years, though obviously its impact has been longer than that. And what we're seeing it take off now, where, you know, just the message that you played from the fake President Biden, I can tell you, I wouldn't have been able to distinguish that from reality. And so thank you for doing that disclosure. That's one thing that my bill requires, is that if AI is being used in any sort of political context, that we disclose that that's being used. And this is also a practice that we should take to other sectors outside of the political sphere. But it's very scary to think about the type of disinformation and misinformation that is already making its way into our election process. We saw in New Hampshire that voters were misled about their right to vote by an audio of President Biden that was sent to them through a robocall. So the effects are all around us already, and it's only going to get worse if we don't do something about it.
Well, you mentioned that disclosure. What else would your legislation require?
So really what it does is it gives a person who has a deep fake made of them, gives them the right to pursue a legal recourse. It outlaws the practice of having your voice or your image be used in a political context.
You have, as last I checked, one co-sponsor. It's still very early in the session. What have you been hearing from other legislators and various interest groups, lobbyists, about what they think about your legislation?
It's been a very positive conversation. We've gotten some good feedback from some stakeholders, and I've been working closely with a group called Public Citizen, which is working on legislation like this around the country. That one co-sponsor, or the chief sponsor who you saw, is Maurice West, who's the chair of the Elections Committee in the Illinois House. I've also had conversations in the Senate with Senate members as well. I'm hopeful that we can get this done.
All right. We have Benjamin calling in on line four. Benjamin, thank you for the call.
Hey, thanks. I just was, thinking that if I limited my intake from just maybe one or two sources like NPR and Associated Press, can I really rely that those are going to be the highest quality and they will weed out any kind of misinformation and disinformation that AI could be providing?
All right, Benjamin, good question. Thank you for that. Dr. Woolley, do you want to take that one?
Sure. I think that it's a good goal in as a hypothetical, but it's not necessarily something I think that most people are able to do, just because of the rate of exposure that we all kind of experience when we use smartphones in our day-to-day lives. Like, no matter where we are, we're kind of constantly exposed to advertisements, to information, and the people that we know are also exposed to that content too. So we get that content through our friends and family. And so while it is good to choose some solid sources that you rely upon that you know are factual. For instance, I really like the investigative publication ProPublica. At the same time, I think we have to be realistic and know that people around us will still share information with us that could or could not be misinformation or other forms of problematic content.
Yeah, I would say the world of people who are willing to go type, you know, www.npr.org into their browser and only consume their news that way is a lot smaller than the world of people who are getting the, you know, eighth hand forwarded Facebook post from their uncle. So yeah, that right. is an interesting point. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, research from Pew shows us that a large proportion of Americans now get their news and information from social media directly. And we also know that people also get their news amalgamated on their iPhones from Apple as well.
Wow. I want to share a text we got from one of our listeners on this topic. Christopher in Brimfield said, "I think the government should step in. We cannot trust the tech companies to safeguard us." Dr. Papakarisi, I want to come back to you on this. What do you make of that and what we were hearing from Representative Rashid trying to do with the legislation he's introduced here in Illinois?
I think that we're very fortunate to have government representatives who are thinking about this issue and are thinking of ways to use the law to protect citizens. I believe that solutions to these problems should be regulatory, behavioral, and educational all at the same time, primarily because regulation will always be one step behind or regionally limited when it comes to technologies like this, because, you know, technology like AI or anything that's internet supported is going to have a global aspect to it. So even if we do regulate it in Illinois, there's going to be content that's going to filter into our spheres of information otherwise. But if we focus on our efforts on creating regulation that sets a framework, general parameters for how what these things should look like, you know, what they should do, that's a very important aspect. Then if we learn to use these technologies, if we cultivate behaviors that are, you know, choosy, are selective, so we'll say, yes, you know, I'm going to get in this very information-saturated, information-abundant environment, I'm going to choose these particular channels because I trust them, but I'm also going to cultivate the ability to live in an environment where I'm going to be, in some ways, you know, assaulted every day with all kinds of, you know, counterpoints, cultivate the ability to process that in our heads, and then educational. You know, we not only have to teach our students how to expect and deal with technologies that may develop in the future, but we have to teach our students who design these technologies and who we then send off, you know, to Meta, to Twitter, to LinkedIn, to, you know, all of these companies to pay attention to these issues so that we can slowly start designing technologies that are socially just. So, you know, it's not something that is going to happen overnight. And it's already, we're seeing some changes taking effect. We're moving in the right direction, but we need to be persistent, we need to be resilient, and we need to keep at it.
Dr. Guzman, one more text I want to share. This is from John in Rockford, who sort of looked at the broader question of government and AI and said, "Why are we allowing the tech companies to rush into developing and installing this dangerous technology? We also have the technology to clone human beings, but the nations of the world have wisely decided for ethical reasons that this should not be done and indeed should be prohibited. Shouldn't this same principle be applied to artificial intelligence?" That is part of what John wrote in. And Professor Guzman, what do you make of that?
I understand that sentiment because I think a lot of people right now, especially around ChatGPT or the deep fakes, feel that just within the last year, it's been shoved onto them. And they have concerns about whether or not it's being done responsibility. And there's a lot of sentiment that, you know, the average person is not in the driver's seat. And there's a lot of sentiment that the government's not even in the driver's seat. It's tech companies. And it is, you know, very much focused in you know, among particular tech companies. So I completely understand that sentiment. I think when it comes to, you know, again, this gets down to, you know, this conversation about what type of artificial intelligence are we talking about? Because it, you know, just the sweeping broad label of artificial intelligence and regulating it generally, what I like so far, what we're seeing, you know, particularly in Illinois, is looking at specific problems and specific types of artificial intelligence and targeting those. I think there is this question, though, of who gets to develop these technologies and where does the funding lie? And artificial intelligence is extremely expensive to develop, is, you know, requires a large amount of resources. So I think another answer to this, and we're seeing this among educational institutions, universities throughout the country, but is also to continue to invest in what we have in our public institutions who are studying artificial intelligence, and just not the creation of the technologies themselves, but going back to Zizi's point, one thing a lot of us have been pushing for is larger ethics and technology training, is thinking about how these get applied throughout different sectors and creating those technologies, but by people who are better informed about the ethics. So I think that could be one way of handling this and addressing it as well.
Representative Rashid, I want to come back to you. We are coming to the end of our time together, but what are the stakes on this if we don't act, both with your legislation or other legislation at the state level and at the federal level as well?
The stakes are extremely high, and I echo the sentiments of the callers and Professor Guzman about the need for government to do its part. We can't make the same mistakes that we made with social media, where we let it run rampant without any kind of regulation saying, well, that's a private technology company. We saw what happened when we deregulated the financial industry, causing the collapse of the economy, essentially, in the financial crisis. We cannot let this go on its own without safeguards and guardrails in place. I have actually introduced 9 pieces of legislation around AI. You know, probably the most urgent one is protecting our elections from deceptive AI. But also introduced legislation to stop, you know, AI-generated content of child sexual abuse material, establishing regulatory norms for AI-powered mental health services like AI therapists and AI diagnosis platforms. We have a consumer protection bill requiring businesses to provide disclosure that they're using AI, others that require impact assessments by larger developers and deployers of AI, and I can go on and on. And also have several bills relating to government use of AI and state-funded research, AI use in agencies, disclosure of that, and guidance to these agencies. That's the tip of the iceberg, and this is at the state level. We clearly need federal regulation on this so that it's not we don't have to leave it to each state to do its own. And we, of course, need international norms and regulations as well.
Just about a minute remaining, I think, Dr. Papakarisi, I want to give you the last word. Everyday person listening to this, myself included, what can we do? What is some one piece of action we can take here to safeguard ourselves or try and address this?
Okay, well, here, yes. People will always look for ways to influence us. They always have. It's part of human nature. Be aware, be vigilant, study up, and listen carefully. That's it.
That's good. I appreciate that. Dr. Zizi Papakarisi is professor at the University of Illinois, Chicago. We've also been speaking with Dr. Andrea Guzman, professor of journalism at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, Dr. Samuel Woolley, professor in the School of Journalism and Media and the School of Information at the University of Texas at Austin, also director, project director for propaganda research at UT, the UT's Center for Media Engagement. And finally, State Representative Abdel Nasser Rashid, a Democrat, has been with us as well. Thank you all so much for being with us. Interesting conversation today on the 21st Show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That is all the time we have for our show today. We love hearing what you think about what we've been talking about, whether it's today's program or anything in the recent past. Maybe you liked it, maybe you didn't like it, maybe you want to suggest a story or topic for us to pursue in the future. Let us know by emailing talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have our weekly reporter roundtables featuring local news from different parts of Illinois, as well as a check-in on national politics with Linda Kenyon. Plus, we'll talk with the creator of a new musical about Forgottonia. Then be sure to tune in all next week for our live special coverage of the Republican National Convention. One of our producers is going to be on the ground there. Plus, we'll have special guests throughout the week. That's all next week on The 21st Show. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Stephanie Mosqueda. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.